Yeah. Again, the series behind this chemical dash. The other part then deals with the functions and the composition of number of committees in the organization. I'm not going to deal with that. I will then hand over to going to deal with the Japanese strategy, so that then from the basis in which a number of our areas raised either by the AG, including even the operation from the scorecard and the finance, are then understood in that context.
Thank you very much, very much. I think the CCMA is very honoured to come and present its annual report to the portfolio committee, arising out of a very challenging year that we have faced in the CCMA and in relation to the current labour market. And the chair has already alluded to the fact that many of the members have been briefed on our governance structure and process. Likewise, just a brief reminder as to how our convener strategy works, which is the strategy that we set out from 2011 to 2015 on how we were trying to deliver in relation to our strategic mandate and the mandate that we have from the legislature here. A brief reminder that we have three strategic goals that we set out there, and which I've reminded the committee before, but let me just briefly cover them again. And that's the three goals are the traditional CCMA to impartially promote social justice and economic development in the world of work, deliver professional, user-friendly quality services with speed, and maintain organizational effectiveness and strive for continuous improvement. Under each of those are various strategic objectives, and as I speak a little bit later on, we will see how those strategic objectives are linked to the scorecard that we measure ourselves by. And just to remind everyone, the CCMA makes sure that it has a very special system to monitor and evaluate the impact of all its offerings, both in relation to its mandate, its goals, and the mandate that it has from the state. And this process is presented quarterly to the government body by way of evaluation, and it's part of our performance monitoring, what we submit to the Auditor General and the National Treasury on a quarterly basis in relation to what the state is going to do. We've made sure we've developed a scorecard to monitor and track what we're doing in the process that we have in relation to that each day. What we did decide in the course of this last year, given the current environment in the labour market, and given the issues for that, we decided we needed to take a step back, or the governing body itself decided that we needed to take a step back and have a look what the annual strategy and the five-year strategy working and working towards, how should we look at it going forward, and did it deliver to all the needs in relation to the labour market. And we conducted a very specific assessment on what the progress was to date and what we were doing, and then we wanted to look at what was happening in the current labour market. I need not mention to all of you, and I think everybody's aware, that the events in Marikana, which the CCMA was significantly involved, obviously influenced much of the decisions and discussions around that. And we believe that in the context of the work that we do, it would be important to review the kind of strategies and things that we were using to try and address the labour market challenges we faced and were they actually addressing the things correctly. There was an evaluation process conducted where we looked at broad mandate issues in relation to the CCMA. And there was a discussion with the board where there was a look at what was happening in relation to tripartism, what was happening in social dialogue, what was happening with mutual trust in the world of work, and really what was happening with the development of that referral relationship. And from that, we developed a strategy, a sub-strategy document, which we'll be using to develop our new strategy going forward. But that strategy looks at a couple of areas. The first one is refocusing our strategy to address the current labour market challenges. And particularly to look at how we strengthen our delivery, we make sure our dispute management and dispute resolution functions are effective and actually intervening at the appropriate place at the right time, and make sure that our discretionary functions, just to remind those of you, that is our dispute management functions and our dispute prevention functions, are operating at an optimal level to make sure that if there is conflict and conflict resolution that's needed, we are there and upfront able to try and address those things. One of the things we've looked at, we want to make sure that we develop a proper conflict resolution model, that we strengthen our understandings in relation to what we're doing. We develop and strengthen our dialogue. We have a targeted and special approach in certain sectors, for example, the mining sector, the agricultural sector, and more recently the contract cleaning sector, and to make sure that supporting those industries in the vulnerable sectors going forward. And in addition to that, we have a post-dispute maintenance level where we make sure we support parties following on from their conflict and we assist them to rebuild their relationships going forward. We also believe that other areas of work that the people may have could assist us in advancing our strategy, and that is in particular to look at our innovation and technology applications and how could they be used in a more advanced and user-friendly way. For example, in international experience, many people use e-mediation, using Skype to access people, but obviously in doing this, the CTMA needs to be very careful because we have to look at our clientele and make sure our people are available for that. So we are looking at all different ways of trying to contact both our users through use of social media, technology like sort of messaging systems, and to make sure that we get the awareness through and build up better awareness to all users who have maybe used our CTMA. We're also looking at developing a best practice workplace. What is a model South African workplace? And trying to see if we can address that going forward. In doing that, we believe it will help us to improve partnerships both between business and labour and the state, and make sure that we can show examples of how good workplaces can operate. CTMA is also very strongly focusing on developing its research and communications capacity to make sure that it can get out its message and people are aware of what the issues are. We've identified that as a really good need in relation to our strategy. Furthermore, in looking and evaluating, we've looked at where else could we target, what other audiences could we target, and we particularly targeted that we believe that in schools, people could start looking at the concept of alternative dispute resolution at an early age. And this would immediately allow them the benefit of trying to understand how you could resolve conflicts without there being direct fights and direct issues. And so we're really working to look very strongly at that. And then an area that we've been pressurized for a long time is making sure we develop our dispute resolution qualification at a more advanced level and roll it out through universities. So we've enhanced our strategy to look at that. And that's what we did in our midterm review of the strategy. And we're going to be bringing those in on board for the next 2 years, and obviously for the end of the strategy to make sure we bring these in more to look at all our broader work in the environment and the work that we do. Moving back to the financial year under consideration, we have the review of the scorecard. I will remind everybody we have the scorecard up on the board here. This is usually the overall scorecard that we put up, which has the strategic objectives that I referred to earlier, those 6 points that I referred to in slide 10. And as you can see, we use each of those and we have a robot managing system where we measure what we've achieved against that. And as you can see in the far right corner, other than one orange, which means that we only partially achieved that target, we actually managed to achieve all the targets of the year. The score that's set by the governing body is that we must be 3, and anything above 3 is a stretch target. And our organizational delivery for the third year of our strategic plan was a 3.38, which we're quite happy with. 3.83, sorry. Because it's right in the middle of the delivery and we're being very operationally driven, so we think that that's quite a good achievement. The areas where we didn't achieve so well are highlighted on the next slide, and those are the areas that are all within the orange and maybe we need to work on a bit more. But likewise, we've had some learning curves, and the best demonstrated by 1.7, which is one of the strategic objectives there, which addresses the enhancements promoting and supporting a collective bargaining. We set ourselves a very ambitious target in relation to 56% disabled, and this particularly relates to our matters in terms of Section 150. I would remind the members of the committee that these are the sections where the CTMA can intervene, where we think that the matter is in the public interest or the challenges for the society, but we cannot force the parties to allow us to intervene. The reason why we didn't achieve in relation to this is because in how we set our measurements, even though we would like to argue that our success, for example, in resolving the dispute in Marikana was significant, we actually in this measure doesn't show us it's successful because we only came in after the dispute had arisen. So we've actually relooked at that with the AG and with performance monitoring people, and they've asked us to reconsider how we do that going forward. But as we've said here, despite the low results, recognizing the target may have been over-optimistic given the adverse external conditions, we did achieve significant successes in Marikana, in the Durans, and the farm worker strike, and as well as in the road freight sector last year. However, it doesn't reflect against our scorecard contextually. And so coexist with our other non-achievements in relationships after retirement, highlighting those. We rolled out our dispute resolution practitioner training, and we advertised for universities to partner with us, expecting to get one or two. Instead of getting one or two, we got seven. So this, of course, while we achieved the target very well, it took longer to achieve it. And it means that we're going to be able to roll out training and access to alternative dispute resolution training far more easily than we thought we would be able to. Likewise, we set a very specific process in relation to our operational targets. And we said that everybody had to be operating at over 63%. And we had actually achieved this, but there were two underperforming offices which automatically then bring down our actual achievement. But if one considers that we have 18 and for 16, only 16 of 18 offices were meeting more than 80% of our targets. We seem to think we've measured ourselves a bit harshly, but that's what that represents in the third line, 3.6. The two other areas relate to retaining talent and organizational design issues, which are internal issues, which we've made significant progress on, but haven't quite achieved 100%. So those are the areas that made sure that we didn't achieve the full stretch targets that we anticipated achieving in the year under review. Just to highlight to the committee and in relation to the requirements of the annual report, we have here the CCMA staffing process and how our national committee operates, and that's a picture of the organogram of the national committee, so I won't go into too much detail. But what is important in the context of how we measure ourselves around being a good employer and a good organisation, and that's looking at what our staff turnover is, and if we have maintained a steady organisation, and we can see from those targets that we don't have a high staff turnover, and that we only have a small amount of resignations and dismissals, which means, in our view, and based on human resources principles, a reasonably comfortable and happy workforce. Also an area which we focus on very significantly in the last 2 years is to make sure that the CCMA is appropriately representative, given that we believe very strongly in having a workforce that's representative of our society. We see here that we've had targets for employees by gender, and as you can see, we are actually quite significantly achieving or overachieving in many of those targets. For example, in relation to females, we targeted that we wanted 45% of our workforce this year to be female, but it's actually 47%. We're working towards making sure we meet the targets. Likewise, on the next slide, we have targets in relation to how the organization looks on a race basis. And looking at the far left corner, one can see that we targeted in the current financial year, we must have 71% of our employees African, and we have actually 73% of our employees are African. In relation to our Indian target, we've actually met that target. And in relation to our current target for the year, we are 1% below, and likewise for the target of whites, we have a target of 14%, and our actual is 15%. This is to ensure that the composition of the staff in the National Management Committee. The next slide indicates the composition of that committee over the last few years. We've been working very carefully towards making sure that it's appropriately balanced and reflects the actual demographics of the country. And we've been targeting and trying to ensure that we meet targets to go forward. We've had some success in many areas, and a few areas we need to work on. And that one of those areas is African females. But I think that when I come and report to the committee this time, when I come to report to the committee this time next year, we'll be in a much better position, because since the results are produced, we have actually targeted very significantly in appointing some more senior African females in the organisation. And then maybe just a few moments to reflect the year under review. The picture that we have up there is a picture of, many of you know, Senior Commissioner Asil Sigurdar with the parties from the Marikana dispute, and that's the signing of the settlement agreement that was finally reached at Marikana. And we considered that a very significant event in the CCMA in the last year. We thought it would be appropriate to remind everyone of the events that happened to inform them today. But I think it's important to also note that we've been operating in a very big and changing environment. That there's a large fragmentation in the people that we work with, and there's splinter unions that are breaking off, and that our role has had to change quite significantly. We've spent a lot of time dealing with verification and looking at representativity, which has not been an area of focus in the previous. also been a very strong inter-union rivalry, a rise in inter-union rivalry, and many unprotected strikes in the course of last year. And there's been a huge demand in relation to the work that we do, which basically is often that workplace disputes are declared, but they're actually just community-based issues, and often not disputes that relate to labour issues. But we find that the CCMA commissioners are mediating quite regularly in community-based issues. We would like to take pride in that we've adjusted and we've adapted and we've been flexible in doing this, because we believe that it's important to maintain even keel in relation to labour markets and try and make sure that we can work on this going forward. And we try to make sure that in doing this, we try to strengthen collective bargaining and we make sure that we engage the social partners in social dialogue. What we've done here is to try and assist in addressing pre-bargaining conferences, encouraging labour in relation to the work that they do, likewise encouraging employers to be prepared for their bargaining season, and hopefully this will find a way forward in ensuring we can create a more stabilised labour market. I didn't think I had that effect in relation to that. As you are aware, there are pending areas of legislation that are coming up, and we didn't feel it would be appropriate to come to this committee without reporting it. Obviously, pending on what you as the legislature decide, the CCMA has begun to prepare itself to make sure that they will be in a position as soon as possible to implement any of the recommendations in relation to the non-state laws that are before the Parliament at the moment. And this is just a side indicating all the work that we've done to make sure that we're prepared for that. So we've looked at the organisational design, we've looked at training, we've looked at what we need to do to try and address this in ways to move forward. And finally, moving into delivery excellence and challenges for the year under review. The areas we focus on significantly is to make sure we increase the accessibility of our CCMA offices. And once again here we indicate where we've actually rolled out more and more, and are rolling out more and more accessibility and making sure offices are more available. Just to remind the committee members that we're also working in partnership with the Department of Labour in relation to their labour centres and making sure that they have access to our case management system and are able to at least log cases for workers who come into the Department of Labour offices and are not left in a situation where they're unable to bring their case to the CCMA. In the year coming up, we are hoping to open a few more offices, both a more formal office in the Valcom area and moving in the Gauteng area into the Vaal. And then we're looking in the Popo and as well as in the Northern Cape for more offices. We've also recently identified that we need to look at spreading ourselves even further in the Eastern Cape, and we're looking strongly at opening new offices in that area as well. Obviously, this depends on budget. We're trying to use innovative and constructive ways of doing this. Just highlighting a few areas of performance in the year, just reminding everyone the core business of the CCMA is conciliating and mediating and arbitrating unfair dismissals, which is about 85% of our caseload. And this slide just basically demonstrates some of the improvements in the course of the year. An area which we're particularly proud, and I'll highlight that, where the settlement rate is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 items down. And as you can see, in 2010, we were only settling 65% of our cases. We're now settling 73% of our cases, which is firstly very beneficial for improving industrial relations and also very cost-effective in relation to our mandate from the state, because it's more effective. We still are battling to always get our arbitration awards out in the 14 days, but considering where we were 4 or 5 years ago, where 35 or 36% of those arbitration awards were late, the fact that we're now in less than 1% is actually quite a significant achievement. I think the other area that we focus on and achieve quite significantly is using innovation, which I talked about earlier, and that is in our pre-conciliation, heard and settled. Those are cases that are dealt with when a worker comes into the front desk straight away and is dealt with quickly and speedily. And as you can see, we have targets in relation to that, which is we should hear 10% of them, but we're actually hearing 17% of those cases. And the target is actually settling 7 of them. We're actually settling 9 if you look at the top 2 columns there. And so, again, it adds to our efficiency, it adds to us being more effective in what we do, and it also shows that we use our budget from the state in a far more effective way. We're able to use it in relation to that. the obvious and ongoing challenge that CTMS faces is probably demonstrating guidance next graph. And that basically is the continuous rise in our caseload. So if you can see here in 2008-09, which was the height of the economic crisis, and we thought that the CTMS caseload couldn't get any higher, we had 140,000 cases that year. But in the year under review, we had 168,434 cases, which is significantly a significant jump. There are two ways one can look at this. One can say we've got a very adversarial labor market, which basically do. But I think that it only really goes to 7-8% of cases that deal with issues in relation to mutual interest, which I think is a strike or wage negotiation. Bearing in mind what I said earlier, that about 85% of our caseload is individual unfair dismissals, and that's what the bulk of those cases are. Now, there are two areas we can look at. One, the first point to consider in this process is that we've seen a significant rise in the use of business professionals, and you'll see it referred to in the annual report, and I refer to it specifically in my introduction. And it's quite interesting. The CTMA was set up to service vulnerable workers, and we've had the biggest rise in sectors of cases coming from business professionals, which is banking, insurance, IT, that kind of thing. Now, you can either say that that's appropriate, or you can say the wrong people are using the CTMA. But we can also look at it in the context of the fact that more and more people in the society are trusting the organization and they are feeling that they can get their social justice by coming to CTMA. So we would see that as an achievement from our side in that context. Having said that, a long-term process would be to obviously try and find a more constructive way for people to build their workplace relations at their workplace, and we'll talk a little bit about that later as we move forward. I think what's also significant for the year is to look at the significant achievement that we've made in relation to trying to make sure we have quality settlements. And this slide demonstrates the kind of achievements we've made in trying to ensure that we actually settle correctly, we settle our mutual interest cases properly, and we address our Section 150 processes. Significant issue there is the second column from the bottom, the return to work index. Remind the members of the committee that the primary objective of the Labour Relations Act is to ensure that people are reinstated if there's an unfair dismissal. And we measure this as a CTMA because, as you all know, the outcome in relation to a dismissal can be issued over once again because even if it's unfair. So it's important that commissioners take into account this when they are considering maybe either awarding compensation or reinstating. And you can see that we had a target of making sure that at least 15% of cases had reinstatement, we made only 12. But it also shows how difficult it is for people to often get reinstated in their workplace. In the year under review, I've also obviously discussed briefly all the areas that we've been challenged in. And this just gives you a list of some of the cases that we've been very, very actively involved in and making sure we've been promoting labour market peace and stability. And without referring again to the non-Americana and again to the matter of the farm working sector, CTMA has played significant roles in other areas which are listed there. For example, finding resolution in the private security sector, which people don't even hear about, and a whole lot of other work that we've done. A very significant thing was resolving the dispute between Carl and Sun International before the $1 million golf last year, which also could have an impact of further causing distress to the economy. The next slide I've put up is always an area that I feel is important to flag the very next two slides, and that is that we are seeing at the moment every single day a bigger and bigger increase in Section 189A referrals. Let me remind members of the committee that the 189A referrals refer to mass retrenchment if you're employing somebody, workers of 50 or over, if you're retrenched that many people in the year under review. And we're doing a large amount of work here. We're trying to make sure we have a process where we try and save jobs, and as you can see at the top there, in the last financial year, we said we saved 26,000 jobs under this process. We also work in the next slide demonstrates and shows you the training layoff process and what we've done in relation to that work. But this area remains a constant area of growth, a constant area of challenge, and an area of concern for DCMA, because we constantly see that there's a constant growing and a constant rise in relation to retrenchments in the labour market, which we think is an area for concern. Moving quickly to our work in relation to dispute management and dispute prevention, which we see as capacity building. We spent a lot of time this year focusing on this work, and in particular when I spoke about reviewing our strategy, we looked at we need to emphasize and work harder in this area because it's so important and what we must do in relation to that. The next slide in relation to this deals with the fact that we spelled 2,220 outreach activities in the year. This goes from anything to making sure we talk on community radio stations, hosting seminars, training workers, making sure we have workplace relations activities, doing single facilitation interventions, etc. So we are more and more every year making sure that we are coming up to ensuring that we do more and more work that is preventative as opposed to work that is only responsive in relation to a dispute or maybe a fragmented data market. And just a quick highlight from the year, from the work in the year. I'm going to hand to our Chief Financial Officer, Tommy Makosa, who will take you through our financial area, and then I'll come back at the end for a couple of lessons.
Going through the financial, I'd like to start with the report that we had, or to talk about the exercise. Right, if we just got that particular slide is actually indicating the slide is indicating that CCMA received an unqualified report and there were no major offenses in that regard. I'd like to add the fact that the CCMA was commended by the AG with regard to the improvement on the internal controls that we have put in place. And the improvement was particularly in the areas of leadership where the organization exercised appropriate oversight and responsibility with regard to financial performance reporting and compliance with other applicable laws and regulations. I understand that although we have improved significantly and as the region community, there are still areas which came out in the audit, in particular the supply chain and management issues that were raised, the audit came as findings in terms of the audit. But what I want to indicate is in terms of the findings, they were not repeat matters. They were just issues that came in the only in the financial year. And but if you look at in terms of the details of what happened in terms of just comparing year on year, we've seen a reduction in terms of the deviations which we've had, significant reduction in that regard. So that's the way that the issues around the budget was only one of another recurring method. And if we move to the financial highlights, and this is just to give a summary of how the organization performed, firstly from its working capital point of view. That our liquidity ratio was at 1.02 to 1, and that came as a result of the proper cash flow forecasting that was done and putting us in a favorable cash flow position with the minimum cover, which was 2 months, which we were able to meet our short-term financial obligations. Another increase that we still was on the income from investment that grew by 30% year on year, and that was the result of the investment that we've made in a short-term basis, which we invested in a lower volatility, and the investments that we made were having capital guarantee. And that's in fact the approval of our investment committee. And the other increase that we saw was on the income, other income that increased by 82% year on year, and that is a result of the other services that they may render in terms of the government services. Moving to the next slide, that also consists in terms of the highlights that you've seen, which as part of entrenching the awareness of legal pursuits, we've had national awareness campaigns where we conducted training on supply chain management policies and the national treasury regulations. Because we understand that it's not only the people in the supply chain environment or office that need to understand these regulations and practices, but it's everyone in the organization that ends up being part of the whole process who needs to have an understanding of what needs to be done to make sure that we are compliant. We further embed the risk management principle also through the awareness that we've had nationally from our risk management unit, and in the include the rich resistance review, which covered both the strategic and the operational methods, the insurance and the OHS issues as they're going around raising awareness nationally. And this also was followed up with an electronic management tool that we're using. Lastly, I think the one great tool that has been of great benefit to us as an organization to ensure that we don't have repeat findings either from the internal audit or from the external audit is the IBCC tool, which is the issue that are being checked for correction. How it works is that all the findings that we've had in the particular current year, we then check the internal report controls that have been put in place to ensure that those findings do not recur, or that not even similar tasks will actually happen in the current year. And we use the internal audit unit to verify that the controls that effective test, the control that we say we put in place, that they are effective and efficient. And then also the risk management needs also test the effectiveness and making sure that they are in place as they intended to. So those are a couple of controls that have worked in our benefit in that particular process. The following statements are the statements of financial position. As you can see, this is something that I'm not going to be line by line, but just to indicate that this is a reporting accumulated surplus of some 8.9 million rand compared to 17.7 million of the previous year. And then again, if you look at the next statement of performance, although it shows the bottom line of the first period of deficit of 8.8 million rand, also this is a method that was approved in the previous year because of the projects that were put on hold. And in that particular, in the year ending 2013, those then were spent. But this has also been confirmed by the Auditor General that it does not hold any going concern issues whatsoever. The last statement is of changes in net assets. This actually shows what was the opening balance from the prior year and then closing at the 31st of March at 8.9 million rand. The value distribution pie chart is just showing how the resources that have been allocated to system is being utilized, whereby you see the bigger portion is sitting on the cases that's in the 38% and salaries and possibly out in there, and the remaining 29% actually being reinvested back to the operations in terms of the IT and all the infrastructure that we need in order for us to maintain our mandate.
Thank you very much, Chair. That covers in relation to the financials. We didn't think that we could come to the committee at the end of a very challenging year without saying to you some of the things in the pink ribbon from the last year. So we do a lot of public speaking and talking about what those lessons are. I thought I would share with the committee what normally takes 2 hours and 5 minutes. And that is, what did we learn in 2012, 2013 around this labor market? Firstly, as I alluded to earlier, we have socioeconomic frustration being manifested that we're able to do, and we need to articulate, by the way, of dealing with that. And that we're seeing a new form of association coming out, the regional worker committee, and one of the CMA, given that we've organized our own organized labor and organized businesses and states, we need to find a way of addressing it. But one of the key things that I'm learning for me, and that is that sometimes relying on the conventional rules in relation to industrial relations has limitations. In the course of last year, I think we all learned that very significantly. In the level of being critical, we're seeing more and more that organizations have downgraded the concept of industrial relations. and the CTMA was very, very proactive in advocating that until everybody puts industrial relations right back up on the top of their key priority and make it a strategic risk in their organization and manage their people like they're equally as important to us, whether you produce the widgets in your factory every day, we're probably going to continue to have some kind of unsettling issue in the labor market. We need to work on that. And then an issue which is somewhat controversial but important, socioeconomic issues cannot be left unattended. And yes, one can argue that the socioeconomic issues that are coming up in labor disputes are not relevant, but if one looks at those issues, they often affect the community and the people who are working in, and we're seeing more and more that labor are taking up those socioeconomic issues. And to put them aside and not address them is actually, in our view, an area of great concern. And we need to make sure we find different ways of addressing these and finding ways of working together to make sure we can deal with these. And then finally, we need to look at how are we doing with collective bargaining. Because we don't need to have a paradigm shift in how we work with that and how we prepare and how we make sure that we actually give life to the law as it's envisaged and not as it's been set out in the collective bargaining process of the last year. And then we're in the middle of a big current collective bargaining season. And I think it's important to look at the slide of some interest. This slide represents all the settlements and the wages between March and now. And I think it's important. people are saying that in the current labour market, the current season has been marked by discord and conflict and frustration. But one has to ask some questions when the average settlement agreement that we've had so far is between 6.9% and to 11.6%. That's averaging an 8.43%, only a small margin, 2.6 above CPI. That slide could be sent before the motor industry settlement. Okay, so it gives us other questions as well, because we have to submit to Parliament in advance. But it's important to note that we're having a wage season that's also marked by some discord and conflict. But if one looks at the outcomes, one needs to draw some conclusions in relation to that. And as demonstrated there in relation to that, the importance of this food support. That's been a very quick run through the work that we've done in the last year, some of the challenges the CTMA is facing. I'm going to ask some of the staff of the CTMA to also hand out reports, further printed copies in case some people don't have of our annual report. We've also made a summarized version because we know the members liked that last year. And it's a step-down report, and please feel free to take a copy. I think with that, Chair, I thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Some women have to bear with me. This morning I had an appointment with the finger on the tape, the man called the dentist, so he left it. You would suck a hole in my mouth and let it be tried. You have to bear it with me. Before I hand over to my colleagues from the portfolio, I think I'll be speaking on behalf of all of us, and CMA, as part of an endeavor, an effort to try and stabilize our activities in the place of work, all the sectors included, it should be appreciated, the effort that has been done. Personally, it is very encouraging for me, very encouraging that you just give you some hope and it ups your morale. Thanks a lot. But for me, before I hand over to my colleagues here, from your experience, I've been stressed that in identifying material conditions, concrete material conditions, that has led to the current situation as it stands in the workplace in various sectors, in particular the mining sector. the agricultural sector. And secondly, I've been tested, and it's almost personal. As a rural boy, I've been tested just to areas where supply and demand do arise. What we do? Do we have information as to what can be done in the process with regard to mobile offices, things like that? Because you would understand most of the vulnerable workers are located in the farming communities, far remote areas, far away from the major centers. That's it for me. As an 18 chairperson, unfortunately, it's just a silent, bloodless coup.
Thank you, Acting Chair. To the presenters, thank you very much. It's been another year in which the CCMA is really impressed by the good results in terms of your audit results, also in terms of your achievement of your objectives. And it's in a sense refreshing to hear the honesty with which you evaluate yourself, even on those areas and where you stand, where you've fallen short. It is clear that that you are working very hard on that.
May I just ask, can we go back to that slide? I don't know if it's slide 51. On my page 13 is 26. It was just one up, sir. I was standing on the very last one. In terms of the CPI index, etc., because I think that is something which is not related to the CCMA as such, but which interests us that are all interested in labour relations and where we're standing in South Africa, especially also with job creation. The one concern I think that we all know is that in the year under review, too many labour actions have been outside the scope of the framework that has been established by law. And we are here in Parliament where we make laws and where we try to get people to live within the law. And I would love to get your comments on to you said the socio-economic reasons, it seems to me, but if you could expand on why is it that people find it more attractive to operate outside the law, to go on unprotected strikes. I love the word unprotected and protected. It should be so normal for people to say, I would rather go for a situation where my rights are protected than where I find myself in an unprotected area. So, if you could just expand a little bit more on what can we do from this portfolio committee side, if possible, to see to it that people will rather opt for the legal dispute mechanism part than the unprotected, the outside of the framework part. And then also, I would love to say, I would love to get that to our presentation. On what you've given here as, to us in a few seconds in terms of the social economic impact and the impact that has had on labour relations. But in terms of the CCMA, your report, etc., I want to congratulate you and say thank you very much for bringing such a report to us in Parliament.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Ask as many questions as we can.
Yeah, no, we'll keep it brief. Because we have two other brief presentations to come. I'm going to use the big guns for those big guys. Thank you very much. Just to say, compare with my colleague here, big question from my side, as a fan of the CCMA, when I read the agency report and I see two black marks, I get very... And you referred to it in the presentation about the supply chain management thing. Mm-hmm. One step back, in a situation like in Ethiopia, when we know that any time there is a breach of this kind of situation, things could go very, very wrong. Why did it happen? How could it happen that the supply chain management procedures were not followed?
board will deal with some things, and we'll, and then myself, the CFO, will tell the court.
Thanks, Dr. Chin. I want to deal with the material condition that was raised. Firstly, if one looks at the mining living condition in Zambia, where over the years, the notion of hostels and companies are in a way of form, it basically then to get push-up position to either transfer a liability from the company to the understanding that they will then convert X amount of rent and send to an individual to say, here's the money, go and sort out to yourself in terms of housing. And I'm saying that becomes a major issue in terms of the living conditions of those individuals, because now all of a sudden they're exposed to a situation where first they need to find accommodation for themselves, they need to pay either rent, water, electricity, and other schooling issues for their extended families in that situation. And then that becomes a major trend that has emerged over the years as a result of shifts in ability and responsibility of companies. And as a result, if you then find those communities or settlements taking actions purely on the basis of lack of service delivery, and that takes the form where those individuals, either in whatever form, they will then raise it in a workplace to say, these are issues that you're concerned with. And that's one. Secondly, the notion that brought and asked by members of parliament around the unprotected and lawful nature of those actions as a result of the following feature. Unions are in a level form, they will then conclude collective agreements with employers in against different areas. And by virtue of the fact that those collective agreements, they are legally binding agreements between both parties or two parties, you then find new formation of workers fading out of the normal collective agreement, so that whatever action that they take and demand that they place on the table, it takes outside the formal collective agreement to say, we have nothing to do with that organization because we are not members. And that's the nature and how the unprotected nature of industrial action takes place. And I'm saying it's as a result of the living conditional standards of individuals. And how does that prevent the other unions mushrooming as a result of it? And then that's one aspect. The second question raised in terms of the outreach program in terms of offices in different areas. I mean, whether in the rural areas, again, the point that you have demonstrated, you're looking at different forms of rendering a service in those areas, either in the form of partnering with the Department of Labor, or we have a satellite office, so that we then choose cases in a particular day, so that we then render the service in that area. Some of the issues that have not dealt with will be addressed by my colleagues.
Thank you, Chair. I think Chair. Can you hear? Obviously agreeing with the input by our chair, and then talking just when I talked about the fact that we reviewed our strategy and we ramping up, for want of a better word, our support in the industry, we indicated in agriculture, mining, etc. And that goes also to partly answer your question on the Sunday table in the context of the fact that the work that the CCMA is doing is to try and do more dispute prevention and dispute management as opposed to our dispute resolution, which is really, in this case, is really at the CCMA. And we are working very strongly, when I said to you that we reviewed our strategy and we're broadening and focusing our work more and more and more on doing in innovative work in advance of cases. But of course that means that parties have to be focused into that, because remember at this point in time, we can have got a legal right to step in that can only get driven by success. We are having some success on that. And I think one must also remember in looking at that, that while, yes, the course of last year and the year we reported to you on, there was a significant amount of unprotected strikes and there was violence in relation to that. I think the number you put up there is the very last slide. You're talking about the negotiations that are happening this year. It's important to note that there have been very few unprotected strikes this year, and there has been a better and slightly more orderly process in the collective bargaining season. And I think we wouldn't have said it's only the CCLA, but I think it's the whole country taking some stock. But the context is that we're looking at making sure that people are going back into following the legal prescripts that are there in relation to the law. So, and some of the work we've done in relation to broadening our mandate and doing dispute prevention is helping in relation to that.
Thank you, Director. I would just address the question raised with regard to the supply chain. As I've mentioned earlier in my presentation, that this was not a repeat finding. It was a finding projected in this current year. And the finding that we have actually emanated from the CCCFA that was amalgamated in 2011. One of the contents of that act was actually misinterpreted when the changes happened between the 80-20 split and the 90-10 and the various threshold. There was a misinterpretation, misunderstanding in what that actually meant. So we explained this to the Auditor General as to what happened and the reason why they did not emphasize this as a, or the reason why they did not qualify as they understood that it was a normal, it was a mistake that someone else, or rather say the legal, a reasonable person could have made. And what they were more interested in was that what are the controls that we put in place to ensure that, because it's a once of, not every year that acts change, but what are we put in place to ensure that the interpretation in the future is done correctly. And we've indicated that we will consult the National Treasury to ensure that all the changes we've made, because we actually had to change our supply chain policy with that regard. And that what we've indicated that we will get clarity from the National Treasury and also more testing, even the relationship what we have, even at the interim audit, we'll discuss it and get the review from the auditors. But hence they did not take it as a most severe thing, because it was a general mistake that anyone else could have misinterpreted it.
Can I just ask that slide 51 that I referred to, the second last one on the current wage negotiation season for the minimums and the maximums? Okay. The one that's on there has got slightly different figures from the printout. Can we go on the ones that we've got on the slide? Thank you.
I'm sorry, just for clarity, I think it was we gave you, but it was a typo that said 111% instead of yes, 11.
11.6.
Yeah.
And there's also a 10 above the max on our on the printout, which we must now replace with 11.6.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm covered. Can I just ask on the left hand side, with CPI in brackets, is that last year's CPI, the 5.7?
It's the CPI from August this year.
5.7.
Yes.
And the 2.6.
It's not much
average.
Above CPI. So the 5.7 was in August, mostly from the wage agreement we had in August or September. So we're saying it's only 2.6.
Thank you. I understand you were a real increase now.
Okay, sorry, thanks. Okay. I'll be sorry if we answered your question.
Thank you. I just want us to go back a little, just before we move over to where I just need to hear your opinion. Because yesterday I asked a question, it's a simple question, about the five principles that determine the survival of an ordinary worker. And the response from the DT, even if I'm not able to talk about it in that, but from what he said, it sounds like we need a different platform. respond to that. I just want to hear your viewers too. In my experience as facilitators, in negotiations, don't you think it's appropriate to include money for transport, for housing, for health, for education, for clothing, for electricity and water? Don't you think those simple principles are applicable in our environment? And why should we go about trying to negotiate about them? Because they're supposed to come naturally. What is your view?
I guess we would share the same sentiment that we appreciate that in the platform. For the following reasons, we don't have the basis in which our collective bargaining takes place. We don't have any standard of measurement when we formulate a demand for when we respond to demand. And this is one of the major problems, not only in our country, but in the global problem where the formulation of demand is purely driven by power. And then I'm saying we need a different platform to talk about the basis in which the political party takes place. But the current base in our country, political bargaining has been better. And I'm saying we need a different platform. But as an institution, one of the things that we are trying to do is basically to build the notion of free bargaining. Instrument or tool, because if you deal with free bargaining, you attempt to minimize and focus on real issues when you formulate the demand, or even before the demand for the bargaining. But it doesn't change the basic needs we bargain in facilitated issues. You know? I think something we share the same thing from the DC that we need a different platform.
Yeah,
what
do you any idea that you can try around that paradigm shift? Any idea?
Perhaps just, I'm not talking on behalf of the CCMA, but if one thinks back to 94, I think the social partners made a very conscious decision not to have a national minimum wage. And I think when we refer to a different platform, perhaps that's the platform and a different platform where that debate needs to take place between the social partners. And to reflect on whether or not at this point in the evolution of our democracy, we perhaps don't need a national minimum wage that addresses those 5 points you raised of housing, education, clothing, healthcare, and that it's accounted for in such a minimum. Now, I think there's going to be a big debate at what that minimum should be set at, but and I mean, some of the major federations have already been very vocal about that, and I'm sure business too has its view. So that needs to happen after we think through the NEDLAC process.
Thank you. I'm not sure this is going to take place in my thank you very much, CCMA. Thanks. It's very kind of you. We can move on.
Can we hear this?
I don't see.
Education is going to look into the following areas, Chairperson, is the overview of the unemployment insurance fund. We will also deal with our performance information, and lastly, we will deal with our job creation initiative. In terms of our overview, we are governed by two pieces of legislation. One is the Unemployment Insurance Act, which mandates us to register all employers and employees in the country. And the requirement, Chairperson, is that people who work 24 hours a month are supposed to be registered with the UIF. The second piece of legislation is the Unemployment Insurance Contributions Act, which gives self-commissioner a mandate to collect contributions from employers and employees. And the same act empowers the Unemployment Insurance Commissioner to collect contributions to those employers or employees who are below the tax threshold. The same act indicates that the contributions that we have collected should be utilized to defray expenditure which is incurred in the application of our act. Our vision is quite clear. We strive to contribute to the alleviation of poverty in South Africa by providing effective short-term unemployment insurance to all workers who qualify for unemployment and related benefits. It is short-term, Chairperson, because we only offer coverage up to the maximum of 8 months. In terms of our mission, we are rendering an effective and accessible service to all stakeholders. We strive to be a sustainable organization with sufficient reserves that make us to be self-sustaining. We also administer the funds professionally. In terms of our governance, that's under leadership and management, the Minister of Labour is the executive authority. The Director General is the accounting authority, and the commissioner is administering the funds. We also have a board member, three constituencies. You'll have your labor with three, business with three, and state with three representatives. But our board is, which is constituted by the Minister of Labor, is not executive, it's advisory board. In terms of our institutional spread, we operate in 9 provincial offices. Our labor centers, we have 126 labor centers within South Africa. 91 of our labor centers, Chairperson, have processing functions. What that means is that a claim is processed in one office. You don't have to move boxes or files from one office to another, which means we have actually delegated functions up to the lowest level. Now, when we come to present our annual report for this financial year, we will talk about another area of our operations, which we call a virtual office. That is where our employees will make applications electronically without coming to our labor center. In terms of our operational performance, we have increased the number of employers in our database. Commercial employers, we have increased them by 5.31%. Domestic employers, we have increased them by 2.46%. The total increase in their employers is 4.05%, and that the total figure is equivalent to 57,000, which means during this financial year we're able to register 57,000 of employers. In terms of employees, the comment
Capital employers have increased by 2.7%. Commercial employees, domestic workers have increased by 0.56%. And the total increase is 2.53%. That is translated to 205,000 workers which were able to register during the financial year end 2012-2013. In terms of the claims that we pay, we also have seen the increase in the claims in terms of unemployment benefits. There has been an increase from 555,000 to 581. The increase is 4.5%. In terms of illness benefit, we've also seen an increase in our benefit, and the increase is 0.09%. Maternity benefits have also increased by 1.85%. Now, when we look at dependent benefits, we have seen it decrease in the same from 24,513 to 20,732. And the total chairperson of the increase is 25,276. Now, in terms of our the number of transactions that we're able to deal with, in terms of unemployment benefits, they have increased from 4.3 million to 4.6 million, and the increase is 7.65%. Illness benefit has increased by 6.93%, maternity benefit 7.1%, and dependent benefit, percent, despite the fact that the number of people who are claiming has decreased, but in terms of the transaction, they have increased by 0.29%, and the total increase in our claim is 7.14%. With regard to human resource management, the total post-establishment at the UIF is 463 posts. During the year that is we are reviewing now, 422 of the posts were filled and 41% of the posts were vacant. So included in the vacant posts are the posts that will not be filled due to the organizational review process being undertaken by the fund. We have a new structure, a chairperson, that we are implementing, so some of the posts that are in the old structure, we need to abolish them. So that's why you see that we have two different vacancy rates of 8.86%, and the other one is around 4.8%. The new organizational structure of the fund has been approved by the Minister of Labour and the Minister of Public Service and Administration. So the new structure will increase the sub-establishment to 559 posts, and the total increase in the posts is 96 posts. And we have this additional post because the fund has been growing in terms of the assets that it is managing, and also in terms of the people that it is serving. Now, in terms of where are the vacancies, we see that in the top management, there is no vacancy. There's senior management issues, your SMS, with 6.7%. In terms of professionally qualified, which is 11 to 12, we have 11.5%. Line management is a 10.6% vacancy rate, skills 12.5, semi-skills 6.6, and skills, which is the lower level, we have a 15.4%, which is where you get the highest turnover. In terms of our financial performance, chairperson, we're quite satisfied with the results that we've achieved. In terms of our contribution has increased by 10.02%. Our investment income has increased by 10.56%. And also our benefit expenditure has increased by 7.14%. Our surplus, chairperson, increased by 35.22%, which means it moved from 11.8 billion to 16 billion. Our investments have also increased by 25.16%. Our accumulated surplus has increased by 29.34%, and our total assets, which includes our properties, have increased by 24.6%. In terms of our annual performance plan, these are the performance highlights that we put through the committee. The first indicator was the funding of poverty alleviation scheme, which is a new thing that we started. Chairperson, you remember that we talked about the pilot that we started in 2010. We need to indicate that it's actually doing very well. Now, the first aspect is the rollout of the tailing scheme that has been approved during the 2011 and 2012 financial year, which was implemented in 2012 and 2013. We have a relationship with MICT CETA, and through the partnership, we are training 1,000 beneficiaries on ICT training, focusing on end user computing, technical support, and system support. We're also working with Telkom and MICT CETA, and we're training 850 beneficiaries on fundamentals of IT, advanced IT, electrical technicians, refrigeration, introduction, and systems. With regards to our job creation investment on social responsible investments have amounted to 3.5 billion against the target of 3.25. These are the investments that we make to create jobs. There has been a 93.8 increase in funding for the social plan compared to the prior year, and this is the funding that we provide to get into productivity in South Africa. The funding allocated has increased from 13.7 million in 2011-12 to 26.5 million in 2012 and 18 financial year. Now, when we go to another area, which is a key strategic objective, is the improvement of governance. We have attained 100% compliance with U.S. board and subcommittee charters at the end of March 2013. We talk about the meetings that are attended and what is the implementation of resolution. We have achieved 100% in that area. Our internal audit has carried audit at all offices as per the audit plan, with 86% of the audit reports finalized and signed off by management at the end of the financial year. We also have a risk appetite framework, which we monitor quarterly, and without fail, the commissioner was able to sign off all the risk appetite framework. We have a system that we call an auditing communication language. It's operational and is utilized to detect and prevent fraud within the fund, because as an organization we deal with a large amount of money, we need to have that system that can help us to curb fraud. 93% of all fraud cases have been finalized at the end of March 2013. In terms of human resource management, we have actually attained 72% of planned training interventions, which have been implemented by the end of the financial year, which is quarter four. 67% representation of women at senior management level has been achieved, and the target, chairperson, has been 50. We have exceeded that target. We employ 3% of people with disability at the UIF, and I think the norm that has been put for the country is 3%. The vacancy rate is 4.3 at the end of March, which excludes the post that will not be filled due to the new structure that we are implementing, including this post, the vacancy rate is 8.86%. Our ICT strategy and the implementation plan for the UIF has been approved and is being implemented by our acting CIO. When it comes to encouraging compliance through enhanced service delivery, we are proud to indicate, Chairperson, that 86% of all claims that have been received during 2012-2013 financial year were finalized within 5 weeks of application, which means we are actually paying people quicker. 5,023 employers have since been accredited to utilize the virtual office, and we are continuously in the process of accessing other accreditation applications. So these are the employers who are going to encourage their workers to apply online and at the UIF. For the 2,000 of active U-filing employers at the end of March 2013, we compared to 35%, which indicates that the people who are using the U-filing has increased by 18.45%. In terms of compliance, the 4% increase in employers registered with the UIF from 1.408205 million to 1.46 million. We have increased our contributions by 10%. With regard to stakeholder relations, we have undertaken communication campaigns, Chairperson, in 9 provincial offices. In this campaign, we're actually making the public aware of the services that the UIF is actually embarking upon, or the services that we are undertaking. Now, multimedia platforms like the TV, radio, internet, we utilize to communicate to stakeholders with a reach in excess of 40 million across all platforms. We have entered into a memorandum of understanding with 3 key stakeholders during the 2012-2013 financial year. And these stakeholders are your VIP payroll, a company, an intellectual property commission, CIPC, and also the transport sector. The last presentation, Chairperson, will just deal with the job creation initiative. We are seeing the Unemployment Insurance Fund supports the Minister of Labour's Job Creation Initiative in pursuing the following outcome, which is outcome number 4, which says decent employment through inclusive economic growth. And these are the interventions that we put in place. One is where we are making our growth more labour absorbing. We are investing with the IGC and the the UIF IGC board, and also we have a training layoff scheme. Reducing youth unemployment, our intervention there is through training of the unemployed beneficiaries. Reviewing the support for small businesses, our intervention is on the funding of the turnaround solution. The Industrial Development Corporation and the Unemployment Insurance Fund commenced their relationship in 2010, and that was during economic meltdown in response to the job losses that were taking place in the country. In terms of the relationship, the UIF initially purchased 2 billion won from the IGC. The IGC uses this proceeds to fund businesses that will create and save jobs. During 2012-13 financial year, the UIF and the IGC continued their collaboration through the issuance of an additional bond of 2 billion, and this has actually brought the total to 4 billion. To date, 20,234 new jobs have been created, and 20,161 jobs have been saved by companies through the accessing the funding from the UIF ICC initiative. The investment in the ICC by the fund is part of the UIF objective of investing 10% of its total investment portfolio in social responsible investment, where the focus is job creation. We have increased the percentage has risen from 5% to actually 10%, and the total amount is now 8 billion that is invested in job creation projects. The transactions for this initiative are funded on standalone basis or on a co-funding basis with the IECC. The business that access the funding receive a discounted rate of 5% for a period of time, after which it reverts to a concessionary variable rate linked to premium. We give IECC this money at 4% and then charge at 5%, and the 1% profit that they get, they use it to actually defray the cost of administering the scheme and also for impairment. In case other people don't pay the money, they will recover that from 1%. The graph that we have chosen is just an indication of where we are making a difference in terms of job creation and job retention. Now, we see that in Free State, the number of jobs that have been created is 1,124 in 2012-13. That's an accumulated figure. In KwaZulu-Natal, the figure is 3,445. Eastern Cape, 4,964. Western Cape is benefiting a lot. You can see there it is 11,576. Gauteng, 15,504. Limpopo, 912. Northern Cape, 365. Mpumalanga is also benefiting through job creation and job retention of 2,455. Northwest is 1,060. The next slide, Chairperson, looks at the area of our investment and also the number of deals that we have made. The total deals that we have made is 199 transactions. Now, tourism has, we actually had 7 transactions, and the total amount is 34 million in tourism. In healthcare, 10 transactions have taken place with an amount equivalent to 209 million. Franchising has also benefited in terms of 24.8 million. You see the chemicals have also benefited by a large amount there, 529 million. The green economy has benefited by 13 million. Textile is 239 million, that is equivalent to 35 transactions. The metal industry has benefited through 50 deals, and they actually received 907 million. The shipping industry is 66.98 million. The media is 112 million. Agro processing 209 million. Wood is 278 million. ICT 234 through 11 deals, and mining only 7 deals through an investment of 396 million, which indicates that in mining you have to invest a lot of money. Now, the second slide deals with the number of deals per province and also the value. The Free State only 6 deals and the value is 74 million. KwaZulu-Natal, 301 million. Eastern Cape, 15 deals, 347 million. Western Cape has benefited, 508 million, and the deals with 36. Housing, 1.3 billion, the deals are 74. Limpopo, 11 deals, Northern Cape, 2. Mpumalanga, 11. Mpumalanga, 14, Northwest, 11. Now, the second slide talks about the jobs created through all these deals. We see that tourism has actually created and saved, has created 171 jobs and has actually saved 73. Healthcare, 832 jobs have been created and 577 saved. Franchising, 90, 100. Chemicals, jobs created 2,672. The number of jobs that have been saved is 1,056. The green economy, jobs created 45, jobs saved is 0. In a nutshell, Chairperson, you realize that the wood industry is creating more jobs and saving more jobs than any other sector. The jobs that have been created, there is 4,548, and the jobs that have been saved is 6,312, and it's followed by textile. Textile has actually created more jobs, 4,344, and it has saved 4,677. The other slide talks about the number of jobs per province. I will just go to housing, where 5,557 jobs have been created and 10,347 jobs have been saved in housing. And I think the other areas are there for members to read. So housing has actually benefited more than any province, but we know that it is because it's an industrial area. Under the training of the unemployed UIF beneficiaries, this was a response for UIF beneficiaries who have already lost jobs and required reskilling for reintegration into the labor market. It is implemented through collaboration with various government training institutions like JobSeeker to train UIF unemployed beneficiaries on critical and scarce skills required in the economy. The project began in a pilot in 2010, and 774 youth and unemployed UIF beneficiaries were trained in collaboration with MedSita. During the 2010 and 2011 financial year, 1,776 youth and unemployed beneficiaries were trained in various artisan disciplines within the mining sector. Now, during the financial year under review, Chairperson, the following initiatives have taken place. The first one is the training of 1,000 UIF beneficiaries and unemployed youth on various ICT-related training programs in collaboration with MICT-CISA. We can indicate that 1,000 of these people have actually completed their training. The training of 1,000 UIF beneficiaries and unemployed youth on mining-related artisan programs in collaboration with the mining MQA. The training is going very well, Chairperson, also in this area. Also, training of 1,005 beneficiaries and unemployed youth in various artisan trades in collaboration with MedSita. So the total people that have undergone training in the year 2012-2013 is 3,005. The next slide, just indicates the dissection of this training per province. Gauteng, 1,520 people have benefited from this training. In Limpopo is 322. In Mpumalanga, 408. 158 Northern Cape. KwaZulu-Natal, 488. Northwest, 315. Free State, 170. 110 in Western Cape. Eastern Cape, 114. Then what it indicates, Chairperson, is that all provinces are benefiting from our intervention. Now, the funding of the turnaround solution, in addition to investment in social responsible investment, the UIF continues as a sole funder of Productivity South Africa turnaround solution. A 3-year funding agreement has been signed between the UIF and Productivity South Africa, and it enables the assistance to companies that are in distress with the objective of saving jobs and keeping people in employment. In terms of the funding agreement, the UIF allocated 39 million for the year 2012-2013, 55 million 2014, and 58 million in the year 2014-2015. For the for the year 2013-2014 financial year, 130 companies are targeted for intervention with the potential to save 10,200 jobs through this intervention. The last slide, chapter 2, deal with the training layoff scheme. We know that the UIF has maintained its commitment of 1.2 billion made towards the funding of the training layoff scheme with the Department of Higher Education and Training. A total of 104 million has been budgeted for the year 2012-2014 financial year, and 400 million over the next 3 years. And in terms of the results of the scheme, as Chapter said, during the year 2012-2011, 21 million was allocated, and we were able to save 3,266 jobs. The following year, we spent 6.6 million. We were able to save 828 jobs. And during the last financial year, we spent 31 million, and we were able to save 241 jobs. In total, 559 million has been used to save 5,406 jobs. The funding was allocated for 21 companies across 5 provinces. In terms of the provinces, Eastern Cape, 4 companies have benefited, and the job saved was 459, counting 11 companies benefited, and the value is the number of jobs saved is 2,869 jobs. KZN only 3 companies, and the jobs that were saved is 1,160 jobs. Mpumalanga only 1, the jobs that were saved is 50. Western Cape 10, and jobs that were saved 684. We also see now that housing has benefited the most, and but it's because most industries are located in housing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm back from one of my disappearing men. I'm back again. I want to admit on the information bill. Thank you very much. All members, there's the input, let us interact with them. But the other thing I want to maybe speak to the members of the committee that we need to think about visiting one of the projects of the UIF. The UIF is one of our success stories in the Department of Labor. And we need to go to the sea and see some of the projects that they are funding. If it wasn't for this program, I think actually the jobs that we're seeing will be too. About people who have lost their jobs, it could have been even more.
Yeah.
Because when you save 2,000 jobs, it means even those who are in those jobs become secure. The those who are there's more than 2,000 who work in those industries. So with this kind of intervention, it makes everybody to be in jobs. And it means better life for the children of those people. And better life again, even for those workers. I just hope that this company that we are rescuing are not increasing the labor loss in the country. Mm-hmm. That workers are paid a living wage, and that the working conditions are up to scratch in terms of the basic conditions of employment and other related labor. So we cannot fund people who ill-treat workers. Thank you very much. Let us engage, honorable members. I don't think we should spend a lot of time on the UIF. In our meeting with the AG some days ago, we were told, and we know, this is the best department. I don't think the best entity. And then we need to, we're talking to the DG that he should find a way of interacting with other commissioners, including the department, and sharing some of your experiences that made you to be where you are now. Thank you very much. Honorable Motaru, Honorable Van der Vezes, and then you can move on.
Thank you very much. I concur with your remarks about the NCT. Just something that I don't know whether you've done any work on it, but if you go to slide 10, I think it is where we're looking at the operational performance in terms of unemployment. In other words, those people who claim that because of being unemployed. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. That's 7% up. And I'll explain myself. I'm wondering whether it's because of the awareness campaign that more people are now coming up to claim, or whether in fact it is because more people have lost their jobs and are claiming. So I don't know whether you've done any work on that. But that obviously we need to look at, because if it is because of the lack of infrastructure, which also means that I have to make the appeal that I made to all the other entities, that in the Department of Labor, there should not be an entity which has vacancies. Should fulfill those vacancies to make sure that we have the program that you're helping.
Supposed
to alleviate hardship when you get unemployed, and we are using that money to fund initiatives which Minister Nzimande should be funding out of the billions that they is sitting on. And the Mining Qualifications Authority is one of the richest centers that we have. So something is just not right for me here. Higher education and training, they've got money that they cannot spend, that is being thrown around like Father Christmas at this point in time, and we are actually supporting training, which I personally think is not the core mandate of the UIF. Also, sir, I would love to you to interrogate this thing of the jobs saved and the jobs created, etc. Because what we've also learned with the Department of Labour is if a person is allocated to a labour broker for a job of a weekend to go and you know, waitress on a Saturday evening at a function, that goes down as a job created, even though the job may be a few hours. So we are throwing figures around here which may seem impressive on face value, but I'm not convinced that we have really, you know, created 20,000 jobs and all those figures that we've seen. So my core plea stays, please, can we improve the benefits, because being unemployed is really one of the worst things that can happen to people. Thank you.
The other issues would be matters of vision. What kind of vision do we have for photo creation? And what other people see in things, they see more than what some people see. And maybe if we say we give over to Snow to tell us what is his vision for the creation. What does he think? That thing that will help us to create sustainable jobs, stabilizing and stimulizing, stimulating the economy. What is this that we are benefiting? Because the mandate may lay somewhere else, or we find that the people who've got the responsibility do not necessarily have the same vision with the vision that the UIF had. So let's hear from the Commission and his team. If I don't want us to go more into developmental politics and discussion, that's losing focus on what we here to do. But it will be very important to share that vision with all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the reason for the increase in our benefits and it's because of additional people losing their jobs, but also it is because of the awareness that we make to the public. Now, Chairperson, you need to claim the UIF within a period of 6 months. A lot of people come after that period, and after a period of 6 months, it's more cumbersome because you have your claim is going to be rejected, and you have to appeal, and in your appeal, you can be successful or you may not be successful. So our main aim of a advocacy campaign is to actually make people to come within a period of 6 months. And through this campaign, it is then that we see that a lot of people are coming to claim the UIF. Now, in terms of the cases that the 93%, so 93% was resolved within a period of 12 months. So the other 7% was resolved in April, which means it's outside as the financial year. The other issue, Chairperson, is that it's correct that our revenue is increasing. I think what we need to indicate is that the Minister of Labour has actually moved very fast in actually improving the benefits. We're sitting at NEDLAC at this point in time talking about the increase in benefits. There are some of the improvements are on the period. The period is going to move from 8 months to 12 months, which is actually giving people more money of course, the maternity benefit is also going to increase to 66%. But we also have actually indicated that the minister from time to time must actually look at the amount of money that you're talking about. And if she realizes that it is more money that is coming in, the minister, without coming to Parliament through a regulation, can actually improve the benefits. It means maybe every year the minister will say, well, we have received more money, and with the analysis that is done by the actuaries, then he can say we will actually improve the benefits. And I think that will happen. Now, our partnership with the teachers and the National Skills Fund, we also have those concerns to say, but are you guys not double dipping? But what we realize is that they may have their targets. For instance, they say the money that we have is we need in terms of the economy. The economy is looking for 4,000 artisans. But according to the money that we have, we can afford 2,000. Now we come in to actually help with the other 2,000. But we are very specific when we talk to them about the other 2,000. The 2,000 must come from our database. It means the people who are unemployed, they are going to benefit in terms of number one training, but they're also going to get a stipend. It means they're going to get an income. You know, and that's why we believe that this is part of a poverty alleviation. In terms of our act, the UI Act, the Director General of the Department of Labor may actually, before he pays benefits, he can actually direct people to vocational training. So the aspect of training is part of our mandate, because you can't send people for vocational training which you have not created yourself. Now, of course, I think that on interrogating the jobs that we have saved, that is also important. Because the board is also concerned, like you are, to say, are these jobs sustainable? You know, but we are quite clear that seasonal jobs, like in the farming industry, we're not going to look at them as the jobs that have been created. We want the jobs that are created permanently. And Chairperson, if you can look at the projects that we, and I agree with you that you must come and look at, we actually created sustainable jobs. If you can go to Free State in a place that is not a thing that is like race, you know, we have put a plan there in our talk for 150 million, and the people in those communities are now employed. The last item is on the vision, on our vision for job creation. We believe the areas of job creation will be beneficiation, and that is one area where instead of exporting our gold and diamond and platinum in their natural state, you need to process it so that you can actually sell it at a value that has been added. So that is beneficiation. The other area is your agro processing. You know, where you take your oranges to make orange juice and things like that. So those are our visions. But also, Chairperson, we need to look into the areas of textile, because that's where jobs are created. So those are the areas that we believe we can play an important role, including your tourism. South Africa, I think, is a preferred tourist destination. Those are the areas that we believe we need to invest in, and especially on the issue of industrialization. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Wilson, you still want to do this tomorrow morning? I was thinking that the suggestion either that we need to visit some of the programs, the biggest and the smallest, you know, and then acquaint ourselves to even look at the books of the recipient company. How were they performing before? How are they performing now? And even check the sustenance of those jobs, including working conditions and others. You know, thank you very much, Commissioner Sumi, and your team. Thank you. You will keep. you or why I think. We're really proud of you. Thank you, bye. Other numbers I'm going to, okay, this means it for the UI. The compensation fund. There is not enough time for us to get the compensation between now and 5 o'clock. So what I was suggesting is that we can take the presentation and then find a slot somewhere the next time, so that then we can, on that day, look at the PPP contract and the internal audit report, so that we can have a meaningful engagement with the compensation fund, rather than fly over things. Today, I think we need more than one day, or the whole day in the morning on Sunday, this afternoon, with the compensation. And that's my suggestion. I don't know how the other members feel. Yeah. So what I'll do is take us through the summary so that we don't have a wasteful, what do they call it? Fruitless, wasteful expenditure. It will be created by us. So, Commissioner Mkondo, fly through something. Let's get the report. And then we can engage later. And that all members, even before our meeting with the compensation fund, the next meeting, we will request a response. The written responses to the AG's question. I think you do have information on how you responded to those. I think that will be very much helpful. Commissioner Mkondo, you've got an hour to make this.
Thank you, sir. Put this here. Come up that well to make a presentation. I've split it into three. The set of a government child, because according to the government information and the CFO will give you the last part of the government. Chair, if you look at the slide, it indicates the areas we need one to take. This overview, CF movement of authentic service delivery outcomes, this data analysis, 2013 major achievements, psychometric information, budget allocation and speculation, and also the last report. However, I don't think I should bore you with the overview, and those are known. I would move straight into slide number 5, which indicates the government deliver outcomes that we're trying to address, which is outcome number 4, present employment through inclusion growth. And outcome number 12, efficient, effective, and development related public service, and empowerment for citizens. With regard to the strategic vision, starting with the addressing objective number 3, protecting vulnerable workers, objective number 5, strengthening social protection, and objective number 8, strengthening the institutional capacity of the organization. Then I move to slide number 6. Which attempts to build the situational apparatus. And I'll finish my presentation by indicating that I think we would love to be where the UIF is, and I think we're salivating some of us in order to find ourselves there. Honorable Chairperson and members, I indeed want to indicate that we're here before you in February to indicate to you the challenges that we are facing, and I think we're also there again here in July, for the end of July, to give you feedback on the progress of some of the things that we need. However, we did indicate that the status quo as it was at the time did not indicate that the outcome would be favorable. However, indeed, the only the general report does indicate confirm what we think was at the effect of our engagement. However, I must indicate that
the biggest area of challenge that we have is in the area of ICT. I think where we have reported here that our systems do not support the business that we have. I think the measures that we needed to put in place to try to address that. And I must indicate that we have made some progress. And I think my colleagues in their presentation have got complement information will be able to address that part. We're still facing a slow turnaround in the processing of claims due to the manual nature of the way we operate and the systems that we have. And as a result, there are a lot of delays in payments, delays in making decisions due to the fact that the system, the way that I also indicate that in the very same space, there are good things that we can talk about and that we would like to share with you. But in the year in which we are reporting, we've seen a tremendous growth. I think that's what it's going to be the real detail. On our revenue side, we've seen our revenue rising from 8 billion in 2011 to 12 billion in 2013. And also, we've seen our surplus growing by over 7 billion, from 2 billion to over 9 billion in the same year. And I think our total financial position, the CFO, we are half the size of the company. In the very same year, we have also done a lot of support to the organizations, 21 of them, who support the initiative of the conference and the area of health and safety and the protection of all our members. We've spent some money there, I think the biggest we've reported in the performance information side. We've also done a lot of work on the amendment of the Compensation Equality Act, and I must indicate that the bill has just been finalized and sent through for renew and quality check, and I must indicate that he needs to be ready. We will be giving to the minister to submit to protect the income from that. In the areas of focus in the amendment of the bill, relates to governance, the governance and how responsible the government. It introduces an aspect of rehabilitation and reintegration in the U.S. That's a new era that we've done. We're also dealing with the issue of dispute resolution, where we're simplifying the current dispute resolution mechanism to make it much easier and faster for workers to be able to access their rights. We're also dealing with the issue of enforcement, where we're talking about the creation of a complete new form of an inspection force that will enforce the compensation legislation. And again, we're also trying to remove some of the hardships of accessing the legislation. For example, where we're saying that employees do not need to pay for them to access medical attention. Once we are injured and we're recovered with us, in the event of an incident, we can be able to go to the doctor to check for continued medical attention. We also dealing with the issue of beneficiaries of our deceased parents, you know. Currently, if you pass away whilst on pension and the commissioner determines that your death is not related to your life, so you broke your back, you become considered on a wheelchair and then you receive pension and you die out of stroke or stress. The benefit and the benefit of the dependent person. But it's very lucrative. Somebody who's wheelchair, who might have a normal person in the past, sitting on a wheelchair itself, can result in stress and physical death. So we are actually looking at reviewing those aspects. Also, we're strengthening the areas of medical attention to ensure that the person is treated themselves. So those are the key areas that we are identifying with the amendment of the legislation. The last part is in the area of collection, revenue collection. We want to simplify the revenue model that we're currently using. It's a very highly sophisticated model which classifies employers according to the risk. And as such, what you find is that we're betting a lot to try to sustain the collection of data, because the employer might register and say, I mean, in fishing, deep sea fishing. And when they realize the premium is too high, a year they calculated, but I'm not an IT fishing. I'm in closer to the shore, so you must reduce my premium and all that. So we're trying to do our little, simplify the collection rate, the rate that the international who are more higher fishing. So we're busy engaging our actuaries to come up with a version that will simplify the collection rate. It's a single premium, so there's no room for addition. I must also indicate that in the same year, the minister did report before the parliament that he put aside an amount of about 3.8 billion for otherwise. However, it's a new thing for us. I must indicate that we already paid here about 25 billion to fund healthcare services. And we are also in discussion with the IPC to utilize the 2 billion that is actually for the developmental projects. So hopefully in the next year we'll be able to report those projects with the I think my colleagues will also indicate that there's been a tremendous rise in the first year of the international community to indicate that we're implementing to all the members of the international community. Honorable Captain, members, and colleagues, I would like to request that we move to the slide that is dealing with performance information, which is a slide dealing with compensation and medical claims, and I'll give that one to the computer to take us through that.
Thank you, Ken. The CAG indicates that what Dan in the 2012-2013, we had a total of 196,000 claims registered during the year, and of course we are operating on two systems which indicated how much has been registered in the old claim system and the new claim system. And that's the total accepted 129,000, only 356 claims were repudiated, and we're still betting to get information out of the 63,000 remaining claims. Here I'm making comparison for the last 5 years. In 2012-2013, we've registered 196,000 claims, whereas the previous financial year, it was only 141. Members know the problems that we experienced when we were moving from the old system to the new system, to the extent that we ended up operating the two systems together because of those issues that members are aware of. Of that, the same information just to compare it for the last 5 years. The benefits that we have processed in the last financial year, the additional benefits, this is where the employer was negligent and the employee has lost an objection against them. We paid three of those claims amounting to 2.7 million. And the burial expenses, we paid 207 amounting to 1.6 million. On the constant attendance allowance, we had 7,257 claims that we paid to the value of 13 million. On the lump sum to widows, it's 459 of them, and we paid 5.9 million. Partial dependency, we had 14 cases in the financial year and have paid 436,000. The lump sum PD to the employee, we had 3,500 claims that we completed, and the value was 95 million. Pension to employee and the pay child counted 295,000 claims to the value of 791 million. And the TCD, this is when the employee is off duty because of the injury, there were 18,000 payments that we made to the value of 79 million. The pension to widow, we had 18,000 finalized during the year to the value of 1.1 million. and this is a comparison for the last financial year and the one previous to that. Whereas in 2011-2012, we had only one Section 56 case. This ending financial year, we had three of them. The burial expenses also have increased. The constant attendance allowance has reduced. The lump sum has increased. Partial dependency also doubled. The PD lump sum also has decreased a bit. The pension from 158,200 to 295,000. TTD also a decrease. And the widow's pension, there is an increase. And this is the comparison for the last two financial years and the values that was spent. We've now got what's happening in the provinces. We are working on our decentralization process. Already we can identify claims that were processed in the provinces. That total of 196,000 claims that were registered have been divided as it is indicated above. In fact, where you see other SAP, this is the new system, and we are still struggling to get the provinces added on them. Most of the claims that are the 169 that you see there, maybe one of the provinces that are indicated above. Again, this is a comparison of the 2011-2012 and the 2012-2013 financial year on claims registered per province, accepted and per province also. The same figures will appear in the previous slide. On the strengthening of social safety net, we talk of 21 social strengthening of civil society funds, which happens in the areas that I mentioned today. We have covered all the provinces in the last financial year, even though in other provinces there were more projects than in others. On the payment to the make of mental aid to the healthcare provider, we've noted an increase of 12% in the number of invoices that were processed, and we've noted a decrease in the rent value of the amount. Whereas the normal average for all the last financial year was around 800 invoices, in the 2011-2012 we processed 824,000. Whereas in the current financial year under review, we managed to process 934,000 medical aid. We experienced a decrease in payments due to the challenges of moving from one system to the other. And I am sure also the members had a doctor complaining that they are not going to see the final patients. But that can be one of the things that we can say proudly that we have achieved to turn over. From quarter three, the doctor started coming for the teleconsultations and indicated that they were also seeing an improvement and they will also start to see greater patients. So we have already more doctors that were refusing to see greater patients seeing them at the moment. And the reason for the drop in rent value is because of the improved controls in our electronic system and the fact that we were pushing on the low monetary value invoices in order to cover up the backlog that were there. And contributing to job creation of the future. Thank you.
Honorable members, thank you. I want to present the next slide. With regards to our contribution to job creation, we have employed 111 intents against our annual target of 100. This is part of our open endeavor on our part to impart graduates with the necessary skills for them to be able to be marketable and find long-term employment after the program. And we have also managed to maintain a vacancy rate of 2% against the departmental norm of 10%. And also in addition, just to inform the members is that during the financial year under review, we managed to permanently absorb 421 former contract workers. They are now part of our establishment. They found permanent employment. Next slide, please. Okay, with regard to strengthening corporate governance in the area of risk management, out of 142 cases of alleged fraud and corruption, we've been able to finalize 86 internally. What this means is that internally we've conducted our own investigations and we've ended those cases to law enforcement agencies for further handling. And also we have successfully secured the conviction of two medical practitioners who have defrauded the fund. And these medical practitioners were even ordered to pay back an amount of more than 2 million, which they have defrauded the fund. And as a result of our intervention around the area of fraud, we have managed to recover about 137,000 and saved a potential loss of more than $1 million rand. Next slide, please. I think we can pass the slide because the commissioner has already talked to the issue of the amendment. Around the issue of communication, we have conducted educational adverts covering broadcast media, television, and radio. We've also done an advert covering beneficiaries, which were run on community newspapers in different languages. We've also run radio interviews on community radio stations, and which we use to educate members of community and also to respond to queries that they may have around the application of FOIDA. We've also run adverts on CommuterNet, which uses medium such as train stations and bus stations. We've also run adverts on national newspapers informing employers around deadlines and how to submit their registration. We've also run on the area of return of earnings. We've also run adverts on television. We've also done radio. We've also done a live advertising on billboards and so on. We have also advertised these things at the airports on those big screens that we normally see within airports. Next slide, please. With regard to the impact on the return of earnings adverts, we have at 28 or end of Feb 2013, we have managed to register about 39,000 employers on our website. We have managed to get the employers to file about 85,000 submissions on our website, and we continue to receive online submissions. And also we get employers to visit our call center and to call our call center and do a walk-in in our center to submit the applications.
Honorable members, for this opportunity once more, I will deal with this for the improvement of financial viability. The implementation of the RL website last year yielded very good results because that gave employers an opportunity for them to submit their return of earnings online. You have to understand that, like UIF, all the employers in this country have to register with compensation funds. But it's difficult for us to know all the employers in this country. So give them an opportunity to go to the website for them to register with the fund. As I'm there too, by the commissioner and most of the people to say that at the end of the financial year, we could collect over 8 billion as opposed to 5.3 billion the previous year, which was a total increase of 3.3 billion over the period. That is, now the employers no longer have to come to Pretoria. Most of them do this via the website. And then at the 31st of March, one employer has registered and filed their return of earnings via the RL website. And as part of that, you need to understand that we targeted that we could increase our revenue by 5%, but we saw that for 266, we increased that by 3.3 billion. And then the enforcement of Quiet Acts to say all these members that have gone to register on the website as well as all the employers, for them to get a letter of good standing, they need to be in good standing at the point that they shouldn't owe anything. As a result of that, that intensified our debt collection, and all those procedures resulted in an improvement of collection of revenue of 4.5.8 billion as compared to 3.5 billion reported in the previous financial year. Because currently, we both can get a tender in the private sector or in the public sector. You need to have a lack of good standing from the compensation fund. On this one, we're talking about how the liability ratio, that's the liquidity part of it. We are saying, in terms of working capital, we are sitting at 4.1 as opposed to the normal norm in business of 2:1. As such, we know that we are a going concern as a compensation fund. And then for the fourth quarter, for the fund has received returns on the portfolio, on the compensation portfolio. This relates to the money that we invest at the PIC. That is, for the compensation fund portfolio, we are using the CFI. We have received 11. It's a benchmark that we use, the short-term investment index that we utilize as a compensation fund. That we're given this by our investment advisor, Alexander Forbes, of 11.91 as opposed to 11.3. Now, for the pension portfolio, we're using the Swiss 40. That is, we're using all the top 40 companies in the stock exchange. What happened in this regard is that we did an asset liability modeling to find out, as far as pensioners, are they well covered? We found that yes. And then as such, we decided to invest more money in equities, which are enhanced in this regard. Hence, we're talking about the Swiss no longer the steady index in this regard, chapter 7. And out of that, we received 16.44%, that is the benchmark of 15.96%. For the strategic objective improvement of corporate governance and services, and then quality and access of private services and information. The first IT governance framework was finalized and it was approved. And then the business continuity plan was developed and it was as well approved. And our call center infrastructure was upgraded to new technologies. Currently, we are aware of how many calls are dropped at the recent level, because initially we didn't have the information to that. Our call center, if like members have visited, you know, the infrastructure has improved the practices. And of course, the return of earnings, everybody, I think the commissioners always alluded to the fact that it has, dwelt life and it has been extensively used by most employers in this country. Project, Jonathan Trump for us to see, since Adam Inc. is one of the electors of the party, because we see that they are benefiting as far as that assurance the mutual association is concerned. So we are piloting with it in three provinces, namely Gauteng, in Western Cape, as well as KZN. So we look for, if this pilot is a success, obviously we look into in future adopting this model. And as much as I think, ask if you can talk about the backlog in medical expenses, as currently been happening at the conversation point. And then I think everybody is alluded to it. And then human capacity constraint, I think this one you all know, I think that they've also talked to it, but I think the most critical area is that people need to know that now the chief director, finance, that is the CFO, has been appointed, and of course the chief director operations that has been advertised, and hopefully it will be filled in the near future. I don't know. Okay, let's go to the financials. Can you talk to the financial position? I just did that at high level, because I think that they're in the annual report. Our current assets, that will include our current investments, as well as our receivables. Currently, they're sitting overall at 16.73 billion, that is an increase of 28%. Our non-current assets, that is our investment property, as well as property and equipment and other non-current investments, are sitting at 2.4 billion as opposed to 19.5 billion. That's an increase of 23%. And our total assets increased by 25% from 32.6 to 40.7 billion. Our current liabilities are sitting at 3.2 billion. This will include, amongst others, your accruals as well as your creditors. And then our current liabilities, this will be your provision for pending claims for not exceeding 12 months, as well as our capitalized value for pension. There was a reduction of 14% from 16% to 14%. This is now the actuary that reduced our capitalized value for pension. They say they are happy with the current capitalized value, so they reduced that by 2 billion. And then our total liabilities, of course, reduced by 6% from 18.5% to 17.3%. And then our total reserves increased by 55% from 14 billion to 23.3 billion. Then talking about the statement for financial performance for the year, our revenue, overall in revenue, talk about your assessment as well as total in revenue, that is for the investment, that increased by 45%. And from 8 billion to 12.2 billion. This is attributed mainly to the ROE website that is being built. And then as far as benefits is concerned, as well as other administrative employee salary cost is reduced by 12%. And I think the Skifida responded to it about what is happening as far as benefits were concerned. Our admin expenses, of course, overall, they increased by 25% from 566 to 424 million. And then overall, other gains and losses, this one, there's no cash flow as far as this is concerned. We're talking about the pension actuarial adjustment, the fair value adjustment, and the impairment for allowance on our debtors. It's reduced by 90% because mainly this attributed to the reduction in the pension actual adjustments, reduced by 90%. And our surplus increased drastically from 2 billion to 9.1 billion during the business current financial year. Can I move now to the budget allocations? Maybe there's a slide, I think that was presented, there was just something went wrong. I think we need to change this one to this slide. Compensation for employees, we spend 98% of our total budget. That is, our group budget was 342, we spent 336 million. For goods and services, 665 million, we spent 418, representing 63%. Overall, for current payments, we spent 25% of our budget. For us, what benefits, this relates to our benefits that we pay to the compensation related expenses. That is for medical and compensation. We budgeted 4.8 billion, we only spend 1.9 billion. You know, that is only 41%. And for our capital expenditure, for machinery and equipment, we budgeted 13 billion, we spent 3.3 billion, resulting in the spending of 26%.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, colleagues. Good afternoon. Having gone through the results of the previous financial year, the question then is how are we going to respond, you know, to the opinion issued by the Auditor General? As the AGSA has presented, you know, 2 days ago, the outcome for the compensation fund, you know, in terms of the opinion is the disclaimer. And the question then remains to say, how then do we turn around the situation, you know, in the compensation fund, you know, to ensure that there is improvement in the areas of the audit focus areas that the auditors focus on. Now, what I've done is I've created a one pager, and I'm not going to resuscitate what the auditors have indicated 2 days ago in terms of the findings that led to the disclaimer, and also the significant methods that they've identified. So there's one page that indicates exactly what is it that they have actually focused on, what are the major areas that need to be attended to, what is our then our plan as the Conservation Fund going forward to address such methods, and I've categorized it accordingly in line with the status to date, how far we've gone in addressing that, the findings that actually led to the disclaimer. I will, in the focus in terms of the approach that has been taken is to focus more on the drivers of internal control in totality, and looking at the various three categories, which are leadership issues that most of the findings relate to, also the second driver of internal control being financial and performance management, and the final one being the governance structure that we have in place. And as you can see, looking at the audit focus that the Auditor General normally look into, not in terms of the financial part, pre-determined objective, and then the compliance, you can see up to, you know, all the two categories of the internal control drivers is basically all in red. And this is all the findings that have actually been highlighted by the Auditor General that led actually to the disclaimer. The only two areas that actually the fund has received, you know, a clean bill of health is the last two categories on the issue of internal audit. In the three areas of audit focus, financial, predetermined objective and compliance, they've received basically a clean audit in terms of that area, and then also in terms of the audit committee, the functioning. So, but the rest of the other areas is a bit of a problematic. So, what interventions are we putting in place to then address all of those findings and that have led actually to the situation that we find ourselves in? The first column, for instance, talks to the effective leadership and culture. You know, there's like, for instance, the findings that will be raised to say that there's ineffective leadership in the finance function. So what are the recommendations that they've actually made us to, you know, put across to us to implement? You know, so the appointment of the CFO was critical in that regard. As you can see, it's in green, and it's actually basically addressing the issue of, you know, lack of leadership in the finance area. You know, the predetermined objective in terms of leadership is in amber, but however, there are measures that need to be put in place. So what are we doing about that? You know, the key is to ensure there's accountability, you know, by the various program managers, the various managers. So we, in the first part, we're appointing program managers and hold them accountable in terms of what they need to do to address the issues of, HR, finance, and asset management, those that affect, you know, the status of the report. Responsibility managers also being appointed accordingly with regards to that. And then on the area of compliance, what is it that we're doing? We're looking at, because there are a number of findings raised in terms of leadership and compliance. We're looking at strengthening the structure, the governance structures that we have internally within the compensation fund, to ensure that we improve accordingly. And what was critical also was to ensure that we adhere to the PFMA regulations, to the GRAP requirements as well. So we intend to coming up with various checks and balances in the form of checklists and so on and so forth, and so on and so forth, to ensure that we adhere to that areas and the thought that leads, especially to the governance and the leadership that is needed at the fund. But then the critical success factor basically is to ensure that, you know, there's basically a common vision and common leadership, especially with the vesting support at the accounting authority level, accounting officer level, also the executive authority level, whereby, you know, they will also be able to also provide guidance, you know, so that we reach, you know, as the compensation fund, you know, we follow the common vision in terms of ensuring that the leadership, the effective leadership culture is actually improved within the fund. The next area under leadership was basically the oversight responsibility that was lacking. We can see in all areas of finance, predetermined objectives and compliance is all in red. So meaning that, you know, this is the area that actually needed to be strengthened drastically with immediate effect. So what I've assessed in terms of the outcome of the assessment is that there's a lack of internal control function that actually is required in terms of the regulations that are coming into effect, you know, in April next year. And then also, you know, there were lack of, like, for instance, periodic performance review sessions in terms of the structures that are actually, you know, governing that process. Also, you know, what also maybe was lacking to a certain extent was, you know, the effective monitoring and oversight in terms of the existing governance structures. Like, for instance, the risk management committee, for instance, you know, the only ones that were more effective were, for instance, as I indicated earlier, internal audit and audit committee. So there is a need to actually strengthen the area of the oversight responsibility. So what we're putting in place is to ensure that the measures that, or the items that led to the disclaimer and the measures of emphasis are escalated to the board level, for instance, where they will be monitored on a periodic basis. So we are putting that, we've discussed with the board members, so we're putting that in place, so there will be monitoring going forward to say what is the progress that has been, you know, met in terms of addressing those significant matters that the auditors have raised. So the critical success factor in that area is also, you know, gaining guidance and advice and so on and so forth, and continuous monitoring by the oversight bodies outside of, you know, the fund, like the SCOPA, you know, a portfolio committee, like, you know, this committee, select committee, and as well as the executive authority over the period of the next financial year, on a monthly basis, looking at what is it that we're doing, you know, to improve in that area of oversight. HR was a bit of a problem as well. As you know, there were critical posts that were vacant. There were basically issues of performance agreements, work plans, and so on and so forth. So in the finance area, you know, basically we are in the process of filling, there's about 25 posts that we're filling in the next couple of weeks. So it's quite critical that we fill those posts, but what is also key, even more important, is to ensure that those posts that are being filled are filled with the people that are capable, which will be able to make a difference when they join the organization, and then are able to, you know, bring us to a next level. So we need to then fill those posts, get the necessary, you know, agreements in place, the work plans and performance agreements. But then what is also most important is to ensure that the assessments are done on a periodic basis. And then we're going to try and make sure that they happen as often as possible instead of maybe the, you know, twice in the financial year, so that we are able to monitor performance of the staff on the HR side. But then when it comes to predetermined objectives, we need to make sure that there's alignment accordingly. What is key is the performance agreements, work plans should be aligned according to the APP, and the targets, the strategic objectives that we want to achieve, so that we are able to monitor that overall, you know, instead of just looking at the job descriptions or the work profile of the or colleagues that need to actually execute specific functions. And then the third level of compliance is basically to ensure that, you know, on HR matters, we adhere to the requirements coming from PSA and other structures, come up with the checklist, and ensure that we comply accordingly to change those rates into actually gains going forward. Policies was identified as another area that was lacking under leadership key control. So what we're going to do is to ensure that these are revised. You know, we have various challenges you know, throughout. We are revised the policies, and then we revise the procedures. The triple P relates to the policies, the procedures, the processes. We revise those, we align them accordingly in the area of finance. And then thereafter, on the predetermined objectives, to ensure that we come up with a monitoring and evaluation framework that will assist us to monitor adherence to the various policies, to the various processes that we need to come up with, and also the frameworks that are coming in terms of the predetermined objectives and so on and so forth. Similarly, with the compliance area, monitoring evaluation is very important, so we need to strengthen that accordingly to ensure that we monitor that on a periodic basis. In line with what I indicated earlier, the quarterly review session, you know, where the commissioner will then be chairing and monitoring and ensuring that we are actually moving into the right direction. Action plans was a problem. Was a serious problem when I did the assessment, and in terms of the actions that we will be taking going forward to address the issue, the area, is that on the finance side, for instance. And maybe before I go through the finance, I've agreed with the commissioner that when you look at SARS and when you look at Department of Home Affairs, they were a couple of years ago in a particular situation as well, where there were challenges, serious challenges. So you know, you go to each one of the offices, you will realize that the way they do, you know, or serve their clients and so on and so forth, is actually very efficient now. When you look at the newspapers and the ratings and everything. Why can't we do the same? So how they did that is basically through the CAIRU program, you know, that is, you know, provided by Palama. So we're going to utilize CAIRU is a management development program, but it's focusing on the service delivery on the ground to say what is, you know, basically the root causes of the turnaround time, why is the service not performed on time, why is, you know, basically measuring all of those number of indicators to ensure that we improve on the turnaround time and the communication to the clients. Like for instance, SARS is doing the same, Home Affairs, you get an SMS and say, you know, ID is ready, passport is ready, and so on. So it's actually assisting organizations to be much, much more efficient with the management development program. So we need to apply the principles of CAIRU in terms of the action plans going forward. You know, there have been quite a number of initiatives in the fund where they try to see where the root causes of this and that and so on and so forth. But then what I saw not happening to a great extent is that those you know, situation analysis that have been conducted in the past, various reports that are available, have not been put into implementation, for instance, or maybe to the level that is will be actually acceptable and improve the situation. So what is going to happen going forward? In the finance side, we need to come up with the audit action plan. We have done that already. We had a workshop, and then we're monitoring it on a monthly basis through the audit steering committee, which is another governance structure. We're coming up with the finance action plan. We're coming up with the predetermined objective action plan, and as well as the compliance action plan. And then what will be more important in terms of that is to ensure that that structure that I referred to, the monitoring evaluation structure, that reviews quarterly performance, needs to focus on those action plans to make sure that they are being implemented accordingly and then that they are achieving the desired results. And then we have also agreed that we will elevate with the discussion, through the discussion with the executive authority, that we'll elevate some of the significant matters to the board level. And then the board and then the subcommittees of the board will actually be focusing on the areas that needs to be focused on and making sure that indeed we are achieving the desired results to improve the organization going forward. So we will be working hand in hand with Palama again going forward, you know, consolidating all the previous reports that have been generated in terms of the situation analysis and so on and so forth, and putting those into action plans, various action plans, and monitoring them going forward. And then when it comes to IT, IT is a bit of a problem under leadership, as the commissioner has alluded. We need to ensure that not only do we, you know, need to have integrated systems that talk to each other and we have seamless processes going forward, but we need to make sure that the policies, the procedures, and the processes that I referred to earlier are actually taken into account once they finalize, so that the configurations of the various systems that we're using that will be integrated needs to be in line with the processes that we have in place. So we have to focus much more on that one. So what I'm saying is actually addressing in a nutshell most of the findings that have been raised, you know, all of them are raising it as challenges in these various areas. On Prince Indomand objective, the key here, the biggest risk that we're facing currently is basically business continuity for the compensation fund going forward. To say, what are we doing to make sure that the services are being delivered accordingly, you know, to the clients and the public and so on and so forth. So we have engaged the CEO of CETA already. We have had talks. He's sending a team, technical team, to assist us to see what is it that we can do to go forward in terms of making sure that, you know, there's no disruptions in the services that we're performing. And I mean, we have continuity, and obviously we liaise with the other institutions that are within the sector, you know, the Department of Labor and the UIF, and see then how can we then move forward in terms of that. But we have seen Prince and Novalo already, and then we will be meeting with the technical team to assist us accordingly. And then on the compliance area, is basically to ensure that the framework that has been referred to earlier is actually implemented. We've got various IT plans to ensure that we implement the framework. It's not a matter of only just coming up with a framework which is not being implemented. And then this is a 3-year plan to ensure that the framework that we need to, the governance framework that we need to for implementing, especially at year 2. But in the third sector, there is the skills in the IT environment, the capacity in the IT environment. You know, we need to strengthen that, and as members know, you know, the CIO went to Department of Labor, for instance, so there's quite a need to ensure that that area happens in the economy. Now, I come to the second category of the key control, which is financial and performance management. The first one being on the, you know, proper record keeping. You know, this is the area that the auditors were not happy at all in terms of, you know, us not being able to provide with evidence, you know, substantiating the figures that have been disclosed, the financial statements. So this is the area that we will find wanting a lot. So in the finance area, there's a need to ensure that every transaction that is recorded or every journal that is passed and so on and so forth is substantiated by documents. You know, and we need to make sure that there's also a filing management system and a critical success factor, either manual or electronic, to ensure that all the transactions are basically supported accordingly. On the predetermined objectives, it's quite critical that we come up with, you know, portfolio of evidence, for instance, POE, because we can't substantiate whatever we say we have achieved without us providing that portfolio of evidence. So we need a pilot management system that will assist that accordingly. And then the two, in terms of the finance and the predetermined objectives, we need to make sure that we're in line with the Archive Act as a compliance measure to ensure that, you know, the duration of, you know, maybe keeping the size and everything is in line with what is required in terms of compliance. The other area was with regards to processing, transactions, reconciliation for the periodic basis. The Auditor General indicated earlier that we need to enforce discipline. You know, we need to have weekly reports, we need to have weekly reconciliations, we need to have monthly reconciliations, so on, 2 days ago. So already we have covered that as part of the intervention, that is on the area of finance and critical demand objectives. On a periodic basis, we need to make sure that that periodic discipline is enforced to ensure that we do the records, they are reviewed, and so on and so forth. The records are kept. Then when the auditors come, then the figures are available. They are substantiated accordingly going forward. And we will be able to resolve any discrepancies in the various accounts and so on and so forth that we find as and when we do the reconciliation. But then we need a digital dashboard as well, or a checklist to ensure that whatever needs to be happening on a periodic basis is happening, and that checklist is signed off accordingly. So what is critical in terms of the success in that area is to ensure that there's weekly reports and weekly plans that are put in place. So I request to all the directors, unfortunately, in finance, for instance, to give me weekly plans. What are they going to do this week? In line with the APP, in line with the job descriptions, in line with everything that they're supposed to do. And then how is then that related to what is expected of them? And then the following week, they give me a report on, say, what is the outcome then of your plans last week? So that's a simple, I think, management tool one can put in place, but that has to be monitored adequately going forward. I mean, people are actually themselves held accountable in terms of that. The coaching was also a major problem. The same intervention, periodic disciplining of making sure that we report according to the various structures internally and externally within the fund, and we keep a dashboard. You know, PFMA regulations have got clear timelines to say when can this be, you know, reported to whatever structure. So that dashboard will assist us to make sure we don't miss deadlines and so on and so forth, and the auditors then having problems with us going forward. So then in that area, we'll obviously requiring national treasury support in terms of the various frameworks that we need to adhere to, the guidelines in terms of reporting requirements, and so on and so forth, including the technical knowledge from the technical side in the fund. I mean, in the national treasury, assisting us accordingly. And then there was an area on compliance. Here, that is where then we need to do what South did a while back. UIF did the same. You know, there are certain gap standards that are very difficult to implement in the Constitution Fund. Like, for instance, revenue management, completeness of revenue, validity of the revenue figure. So we're looking at, you know, getting an exemption, like SARB did, like UIF did, you know, with the assistance of ASB, accounting standard board, you know, and then thereafter to the National Treasurer. You know, once we get that exemption, we'll be able to put measures in place to ensure revenue is complete, and so that we can just record it and then when we receive it. And then we don't, you know, find ourselves wanting, because about 50% of the findings and the 50% of the areas that led to the disclaimer relate to revenue, for instance. So if we do get that exemption, it will assist us accordingly. So the plan is to get them by the end of this financial year, you know, going forward, then we put measures to address that. So I'm just going to skip chapter 10 for the sake of time, you know, to the next other critical areas which I feel like are important. On the IT controls, under financial and performance management, what was lacking is that there were no auditors, for instance, that are generated on a daily basis. We check and we say, was this transaction, you know, a valid transaction? So is there documentation that is actually, you know, substantiating the transaction that needs to be done? So we'll be monitoring those, you know, checking the auditors going forward from the system, putting in place the framework that I alluded to, under leadership, policies, framework, automating that. And then even CSMA area, you know, refer to a monitor evaluation system. So we need to see what they have in place. So as well, we just put the, just basically put it there, but then I'm just coming across the two presentations we made. They've got a monitor evaluation system that will assist us to monitor, especially greater demand objectives. Are we meeting our targets? What are the interventions? What areas are not working? You know, the finance side or other areas. So we need to put that in place, and then we use that to actually follow up as well, agency, as well as on the compliance side. That's important. But then if we find that there's areas where there's audit trails that are not substantiated, the irregular processing of transactions, there should be consequences, as the Auditor General indicated 2 days ago, you know, in terms of the critical success factors. Once we have, you know, lack of, you know, commitment in terms of monitoring evaluation, lack of reporting, lack of substantiating information, and then, you know, we need to have the consequences going forward. Under governance, only one leg was actually problematic. That is the area of risk management. You know, I see risk management as being the gatekeeper on most of these things in all areas. You know, so AGSA was not happy about the level of risk management in the Compensation Fund, be it in terms of financial assessment of risk, principles and objectives and compliance issues. It was actually, we actually found one thing. So we're looking at making sure that in the finance field, for instance, and the chief director HR is alluded to the fraud, issues of fraud and so on and so forth, that we improve in terms of those areas. But in addition to that, ACL, the system we're considering, there were workshops last week to look at maybe expanding the licenses to ensure that, you know, we use ACL as a gatekeeper. Like in supply chain management, for instance, we need to make sure that, you know, there are no transactions with public servants, for instance. Because that practice is not, you know, allowed in terms of the regulation. So ACM will help us to do the data intervention and be able to detect those things before they become, you know, areas of findings and that leads to, you know, negative policy opinions in terms of the auditor general. In the area of predetermined objectives, we're looking at making sure that priority assessments are done. Are we in a position to achieve our targets that we plan to achieve? So then come up with the mitigating factors as well, and then those meet, then monitor on a periodic basis to ensure that we are actually achieving our targets accordingly, and then also, you know, not attracting significant findings. Then in the area of compliance, I mean, National Treasury has basically sanctioned the system called ban oil, which we, you know, measures the level of adherence to the compliance, all in terms of all the regulations, all the acts, and so on and so forth. So we need to utilize that, and already the initiative with basically the internal audit to address that area. And then those that are highlighted in yellow under interventions are those areas that are already in significant progress to implement within the fund. Then those that are not highlighted, obviously, planned work going forward. And then also in the critical success sectors, those are highlighted in yellow, are also already in progress of implementation. And then the pillars that are actually needed to ensure that we succeed in the next 2, 3, 4 years are actually highlighted right at the bottom. And then those that are highlighted in yellow as well, are, we started on those to improve the governance structures, which is the first pillar there. And then to partner for success in terms of like talking to other structures, like, you know, talking to staff, talking to, you know, CETA, talking to National Treasury, and so on and so forth, so that we can strengthen relationships, you know, to ensure that we improve going forward. UIF, talking to UIF, and all those other, you know, entities, Home Affairs, you know, start, how do they do it, and so that we can, you know, share in terms of the measures that need to be communicated. In a nutshell, Chairperson, I'm sorry I took long, but this is just the one picture showing how we are addressing the issues of AGSA going forward. This is about 80% of what we still need to do. You know, we need to expand going forward in terms of this, but this was based on, you know, the 2 weeks that have been, you know, actually in the fund. I started 16 September, and the 3 weeks that have been in the fund, this is my, in terms of my assessment of what needs to happen going forward. But then, as Chairperson has indicated earlier, we will come later to present in detail other measures that respond to the other pillars that are indicated there in terms of what we're going to do. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I'm not sure what I said here, and I feel I'm very, very hopeful, and somehow I feel this light in the tunnel, the end of the tunnel, and that light is not of a good thing coming to crush us. It's actually light that is, you know, the light that's going to shine our way into cleaner pastures. The next time we meet, thank you very much. That's it.